Welcome to Sightseeing Japan, the podcast where we explore the land of ancient fantasy. I'm Paul Bresson.
And I'm Jason Ealing. What's up, Paul?
Oh, life is good.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it.
Yeah. Other than that, absolutely nothing.
All right.
My busy stretch is over.
That's good.
I'm in the unbusy stretch for a couple weeks at least.
Is it going to get busy again before we leave for Japan?
Yeah, I mean, the final touches, make sure everything's ready to go. I got to tie up all my loose ends at work and all that stuff.
Yeah. Cool.
How are you?
I got to be honest, man. I'm feeling kind of not great at the moment.
Oh, good thing you got vacation coming up.
Yeah, yeah. That'll be good. I just went to the doctor yesterday for a COVID shot and a flu shot in the same arm, and it is quite sore.
Yeah,
it's actually better now than it was this morning, I think, but it hurts to lift it.
Yeah.
I'm kind of feeling like I'm starting to get a headache and stuff, like just kind of the general malaise, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I sometimes get that. I sometimes don't. After the
I don't
shots.
Usually, but maybe it was just the two at once.
Two at once, I do it.
Yeah.
Well, you're prepared.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to read some stories. We're doing another bonus folktale episode because when this episode is released, we're going to be in Japan, I believe, right? I didn't look at the actual release date, but I think we're still going to be in Japan, yeah?
We'll be like maybe on a plane coming back. I think it'll be kind of right at the end.
Yeah, sounds right.
So we're going to tell you some stories today.
I'm still feeling a little bit Halloween-y. I found some nice, spooky, creepy ones.
Okay, nice.
And I don't know what we're going to have time for because one of them is super long, but we'll see.
Okay. Looking forward to it. I like spooky.
Me too.
I've just been starting to think about spooky, scary stuff. I'm like, I got to watch some scary movies or something.
Yeah. Did I tell you I just read the book that Hellraiser, the movie, is based on?
No.
Yeah, it's actually really good.
Okay.
Like I've been since I got my Kindle, I've been reading tons of books, right? And some of the writing, you know, isn't that great.
Sure.
And some of the books I've been reading, it's like, wow, this person really has a way with words, you know? And that book, I believe it's called The Hellbound Heart. I can never remember the names or the authors of the books that I'm reading.
I'm with you there.
But it's really good. I'll leave it there. It's good.
Yeah, you like look at the title once at the start and then you like read for hours. Like, I don't remember what the title was.
Yeah.
I didn't even know there was a book that movie was based off of.
I don't think I did either. And what's weird is, like, you know the pinhead guy that's, like, on the cover of that movie? He's, like, the star of the show.
Yeah.
They describe the pins, like, once that character appears for, like, 30 seconds and then, is barely a part of the story.
That's the only thing I remember about the movie.
I know. I want to watch the movie again now because I...
We should.
We should. Yeah. It's still Halloween season.
Oh, yeah.
All right. We'll plan that.
Good.
Are you ready to get to some stories?
Yeah, let's do it.
You said you had a few of them picked out, right?
Short ones? Yeah, I went with some shorter ones today. We both did really long ones last time, and I was like, let me maybe get through a few today.
Okay. Let's start with yours, and then I'll do a real long one, and then we'll see what else we have time for.
Okay. So the first story I've got is from a collection called Kwaidan, Stories and Studies of Strange Things by Lafcadio Hearn.
I'd like to point out that spelling, Kwaidan, Kwaidan, that's like a weird historical thing, but it's actually pronounced Kaidan.
Okay. Some of these I was reading, and there are some weird spellings.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm pretty sure I know what that is, and I've never seen it spelled like that.
Right. I think the way that they translated Japanese words into English was not quite as standardized as it is these days.
Yeah, I think we've run into that before on some of these.
Yep.
So I'm going to read a story called Ubazakura. 300 years ago, in the village called Asamimura, in the district called Onsengori, in the province of Iyo, there lived a good man named Tokubei. This Tokubei was the richest person in the district, and the muraosa, or headman, of the village. In most matters he was fortunate, but he reached the age of 40 without knowing the happiness of becoming a father. Therefore he and his wife, in the affliction of their childlessness—
I don't consider that an affliction. frankly.
I was just thinking in my head, like, I'm approaching 40 and childless. Hold on.
You're afflicted.
Is this a bad thing? Let's see. Where was I? Oh, yeah. Their affliction of childlessness. They addressed many prayers to the divinity Fudo Myo-O, who had a famous temple called Saihoji in Asamimura. At last, their prayers were heard. The wife of Tokubei gave birth to a daughter. The child was very pretty, and she received the name of Suyu. As the mother's milk was deficient, a milk nurse called Osode was hired for the little one. Otsuyu grew up to be a very beautiful girl, but at the age of 15, she fell sick, and the doctors thought that she was going to die. In that time, the nurse Osode, who loved Otsuyu with a real mother's love, went to the temple Saihoji and fervently prayed to Fudo-sama on behalf of the girl. Every day for 21 days, she went to the temple and prayed. And at the end of that time, Otsuyu suddenly completely recovered. Then there was great rejoicing in the house of Tokubei, and he gave a feast to all his friends in celebration of the happy event. But on the night of the feast, the nurse Osode was suddenly taken ill, and on the following morning, the doctor, who had been summoned to attend to her, announced that she was dying. Then the family in great sorrow gathered about her bed to bid her farewell, but she said to them, "It is time that I should tell you something which you do not know. My prayer has been heard. I besought Fudo-sama that I might be permitted to die in the place of Otsuyu.
Oh, snap.
And this great favor has been granted me. Therefore, you must not grieve about my death. But I have one request to make. I promised Fudo-sama that I would have a cherry tree planted in the garden of Saihoji for thank offering and a commemoration. Now I shall not be able myself to plant the tree there, so I must beg that you will fulfill that vow for me. Goodbye, dear friends, and remember that I was happy to die for Otsuyu's sake."
That's pretty selfless.
Yeah, it is. I'm happy to die.
Would you give your life so I could live, Paul?
As long as there are no follow-up questions, yes.
Okay, ditto.
I think we've been arguing about this for years, but I don't ever want to go to your funeral, bro. I get to die first.
No, I get to die first.
Stop.
Yia insists that she gets to die before me, so I can't be just sitting around without either of you.
Okay, so I just have to die before Yia.
I mean, then I'd still be stuck without either of you.
Well, that would become your problem at that point.
It's not selfless, Paul.
No, it's not. After the funeral of Osode, a young cherry tree, the finest that could be found, was planted in the garden of Saihoji by the parents of Otsuyu. The tree grew and flourished, and on the 16th day of the second month of the following year, the anniversary of Osode's death, it blossomed in a wonderful way. So it continued to blossom for 254 years, always upon the 16th day of the second month, and its flowers, pink and white, were like the nipples of a woman's breast bedewed with milk.
Most beautiful flowers.
And the people called it Uba Zakura, the cherry tree of the milk nurse.
Wow.
I find the 254 years interesting, too. Like, where did that come from? I flowered for 254 years. Is that a
254
special or sacred number or something? What's the computer one, like bits?
256?
256, right, yeah. So, I mean, they wouldn't have known that back then, right? But maybe, who knows?
I don't think that's connected. I don't think that's quite it. But yeah, that is an interesting, very specific number.
It's a long time. It's definitely a long time.
Yeah. Paul, if we're talking about nipples bedewed with milk, do I have to mark this explicit?
It's historical.
That's biology, right?
It's historical and biological, so I would guess no.
Thank you.
But okay. Didn't you say you had like a really scary story? So I don't know.
It's not bloody though. It depends how far we get. One of my stories has a lot of gore in it.
Okay.
The other one does not.
Okay. That was pretty quick. Do you want me to do one more before you go?
No, I want to go.
Okay, okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
I mean, do you have another one that's like that short?
Maybe. I read them all, but I don't remember. You go. You go.
Okay.
If there's time left, I'll throw some more.
I'll take it. I've had my eye on this one for a while, Paul.
Oh, yeah?
I'm reading from the same collection, Rokurokubi.
Okay.
Does that ring any bells? It's been 5 years or so since we talked about this word.
Sounds like vaguely familiar, but I cannot place.
In our first Halloween special about yokai, we talked about Rokurokubi, and I remember because this is one of my favorite ones. This is the one where it looks like a human, but the head, well, the neck can stretch out and the head can kind of float around on its own, you know?
Okay, yeah, that's a really cool one.
And after I read this, I was a little confused because it didn't quite line up with what I had heard about these, so I looked it up. Apparently, there are two varieties of these. One of them is where the neck stretches out really long and the head is floating about, but it's still like attached to the body.
Yeah.
But there's another version where the head just completely disconnects from the body and can go floating around on its own.
They're both super creepy in their own way. I kind of like both of them.
Yeah.
Do you want me on voices or footnotes for this one?
Ooh. Can you open two tabs?
Probably.
Because I think there might be some voices. Okay, here we go. Rokurokubi. Nearly 500 years ago, there was a samurai named Isogai Heidazaemon Taketsura in the service of the Lord Kikuji of Kyushu. This Isogai had inherited from many warlike ancestors a natural aptitude for military exercises and extraordinary strength. While yet a boy, he had surpassed his teachers in the art of swordsmanship, in archery, and in the use of the spear, and had displayed all the capacities of a daring and skillful soldier. Afterwards, in the time of the Eikyo War...
The period of Eikyo lasted from 1429 to 1441.
Thank you, Paul. He so distinguished himself that high honors were bestowed upon him. But when the house of Kikuji came to ruin, Isogai found himself without a master. He might then easily have obtained service under another daimyo, but as he had never sought distinction for his own sake alone, and as his heart remained true to his former lord, he preferred to give up the world. So he cut off his hair and became a traveling priest, taking the Buddhist name of Kairyo. By the way, this Kairyo has that same weird spelling as Kaidan. It's got the K-W-A-I.
Kairyo.
Yeah. But always under the Koromo.
The upper robe of a Buddhist priest is thus called.
Under the Koromo of the priest, Kairyo kept warm within him the heart of the samurai. As in other years, he had laughed at peril, so now also he scorned danger. And in all weathers and all seasons, he journeyed to preach the good law in places where no other priest would have dared to go. For that age was an age of violence and disorder, and upon the highways there was no security for the solitary traveler, even if he happened to be a priest. In the course of his first long journey, Kairyo had occasion to visit the province of Kai.
Present-day Yamanashi Prefecture.
One evening, as he was traveling through the mountains of that province, darkness overcame him in a very lonesome district, leagues away from any village. So he resigned himself to pass the night under the stars, and having found a suitable grassy spot by the roadside, he lay down there and prepared to sleep. He had always welcomed discomfort. Even a bare rock was for him a good bed, when nothing better could be found, and the root of a pine tree an excellent pillow. His body was iron, and he never troubled himself about dews or rain or frost or snow.
Or snow. He wakes up covered in like a foot of snow.
Nothing to do.
Shakes it off, gets up. That's awesome.
Yeah. Scarcely had he lain down when a man came along the road, carrying an axe and a great bundle of chopped wood. This woodcutter halted on seeing Kairyo lying down, and after a moment of silent observation, said to him in a tone of great surprise. You want to take this, Paul?
Sure.
Lumberjack, gruff guy, think flannel.
What kind of a man can you be? I just always sound like Paul.
I was a little gruffer than a normal Paul, I think.
gruff voice. What kind of a man can you be, good sir, that you dare to lie down alone in such a place as this? There are haunters about here, many of them. Are you not afraid of hairy things?
I love that, hairy things.
My friend, cheerfully answered Kairyo, I am only a wandering priest, a cloud and water guest, as folks call it. Unsui no ryokaku.
A term for itinerant priests.
And I am not in the least afraid of hairy things, if you mean goblin foxes, or goblin badgers, or any creatures of that kind. As for lonesome places, I like them. They are suitable for meditation. I'm accustomed to sleeping in the open air, and I've learned never to be anxious about my life. I mean, if I'm laying down and there's like a bunch of snow that falls on me, I just get up, no problem. Like, it's nothing to me.
You must be indeed a brave man, Sir Priest.
The peasant responded.
I'm a peasant now? I suppose woodcutters.
Yeah. Are peasants. You think that noblemen cut wood?
No. To lie down here? This place has a bad name. A very bad name. But as the proverb has it, Kunchi Ayayuki ni Chikayo Razu. The superior man does not needlessly expose himself to peril. And I must assure you, sir, that it is very dangerous to sleep here.
Sorry, Paul, I think you got less gruff. Now you sound like Paul.
Therefore, although my house is only a wretched thatched hut, let me beg of you to come home with me at once. In the way of food, I have nothing to offer you, but there is a roof at least, and you can sleep under it without risk.
He spoke earnestly, and Kairyo, liking the kindly tone of the man, accepted this modest offer. The woodcutter guided him along a narrow path leading up from the main road through mountain forest. It was a rough and dangerous path, sometimes skirting precipices, sometimes offering nothing but a network of slippery roots for the foot to rest upon, sometimes winding over or between masses of jagged rock. But at last Kairyo found himself upon a cleared space at the top of a hill, with a full moon shining overhead, and he saw before him a small thatched cottage, cheerfully lighted from within. The woodcutter led him to a shed at the back of the house, whither water had been conducted through bamboo pipes from some neighboring stream, and the two men washed their feet. Beyond the shed was a vegetable garden, and a grove of cedars and bamboos, and beyond the trees appeared the glimmer of a cascade, pouring from some loftier height, and swaying in the moonshine like a long white robe. As Kairyo entered the cottage with his guide, he perceived four persons, men and women, warming their hands at a little fire kindled in the row of the principal apartment. There's a footnote on a row.
A sort of little fireplace contrived in the floor of a room is thus described. The row is usually a square shallow cavity lined with metal and half filled with ashes in which charcoal is lighted.
I've seen that.
Yeah, me too.
They bowed low to the priest and greeted him in the most respectful manner. Kairyo wondered that persons so poor and dwelling in such a solitude should be aware of the polite forms of greeting.
These are good people, he thought to himself, and they must have been taught by someone well acquainted with the rules of propriety.
Then turning to his host, the Aruji, or housemaster, as the others called him, Kairyo said,
From the kindness of your speech and from the very polite welcome given me by your household, I imagine that you have not always been a woodcutter. Perhaps you formerly belonged to one of the upper classes?
By the way, Paul, I mentioned that I was reading that historical fiction novel that takes place in old Japan in the Heian period.
Yeah.
In that book, they also talk about the upper class as, quote-unquote, good people. I thought that was interesting. Like, I wonder how that would have been said in Japanese. And it's also kind of weird. Like, it implies that the people that aren't rich and upper class are, like, not good people or something.
Very classist.
Yeah. Anyway, smiling, the woodcutter answered,
Sir, you are not mistaken. Though now living as you find me, I was once a person of some distinction. My story is the story of a ruined life. Ruined by my own fault. I used to be in the service of a daimyo, and my rank in that service was not inconsiderable. but I loved women and wine too well, and under the influence of passion I acted wickedly. My selfishness brought about the ruin of our house and caused the death of many persons. Retribution followed me, and I long remained a fugitive in the land. Now I often pray that I may be able to make some atonement for the evil which I did, and to reestablish the ancestral home. But I fear that I shall never find any way of so doing. Nevertheless, I try to overcome the karma of my errors by sincere repentance, and by helping as far as I can those who are unfortunate.
I want to know more about that story. How do a bunch of people die because this guy liked women and wine too much?
I'm kind of happy that I was upper class now, but also a terrible person, apparently.
Yeah.
You win some, you lose some.
Sure. Kaidyo was pleased by this announcement of good resolve, and he said to the Aruji,
"My friend, I have had occasion to observe that men, prone to folly in their youth, may in after years become very earnest in right living. In the Holy Sutras it is written that those strongest in wrongdoing can become, by power of good resolve, the strongest in right doing. I do not doubt that you have a good heart, and I hope that better fortune will come to you. Tonight I shall recite the sutras for your sake, and pray that you may obtain the force to overcome the karma of any past errors."
With these assurances, Kaidyo bade the Aruji good night, and his host showed him to a very small side room where a bed had been made ready. Then all went to sleep, except the priest, who began to read the sutras by the light of a paper lantern. Until a late hour he continued to read and pray. Then he opened a little window in his little sleeping room to take a last look at the landscape before lying down. The night was beautiful. There was no cloud in the sky, there was no wind, and the strong moonlight threw down sharp black shadows of foliage and glittered on the dews of the garden. Shrillings of crickets and bell insects.
Direct translation of Suzumushi, a kind of cricket with a distinctive chirp like a tiny bell. Whence the name?
The bell insects made a musical tumult, and the sound of the neighboring cascade deepened with the night. Kaidyo felt thirsty as he listened to the noise of the water, and remembering the bamboo aqueduct at the rear of the house, he thought that he could go there and get a drink without disturbing the sleeping household. Very gently, he pushed apart the sliding screens that separated his room from the main apartment, and he saw, by the light of the lantern, five recumbent bodies without heads.
Whoa. I wasn't sure where this was going, but that escalated quickly.
Right? Just out of nowhere. For one instant, he stood bewildered, imagining a crime. But in another moment, he perceived that there was no blood, and that the headless necks did not look as if they had been cut. Then he thought to himself,
"Either this is an illusion made by goblins, or I've been lured into the dwelling of a Rokurokubi."
Now, a Rokurokubi is ordinarily conceived as a goblin whose neck stretches out to great lengths, but which nevertheless always remains attached to its body.
In the book Soshinki,
a Chinese collection of stories on the supernatural,
it is written that if one find the body of a Rokurokubi without its head, and remove the body to another place, the head will never be able to join itself again to the neck. And the book further says that when the head comes back and finds that his body has been moved, it will strike itself upon the floor three times, bounding like a ball, and will pant as in great fear and presently die. Now if these be Rokurokubi, they mean me no good, so I shall be justified in following the instructions of the book.
He seized the body of the Aruji by the feet, pulled it to the window, and pushed it out. Then he went to the back door, which he found barred, and he surmised that the heads had made their exit through the smoke hole in the roof, which had been left open. Gently unbarring the door, he made his way to the garden, and proceeded with all possible caution to the grove beyond it. He heard voices talking in the grove, and he went in the direction of the voices, stealing from shadow to shadow until he reached a good hiding place. Then, from behind a trunk, he caught sight of the heads, all five of them, flitting about and chatting as they flitted. They were eating worms and insects which they found on the ground or among the trees. Presently, the head of the Aruji stopped eating and said,
"Ah, that traveling priest who came tonight. How fat all his body is. When we shall have eaten him, our bellies will be well filled. I was foolish to talk to him as I did. It only set him to reciting the sutras on behalf of my soul. To go near him while he is reciting would be difficult, and we cannot touch him so long as he is praying. But as it is now nearly morning, perhaps he has gone to sleep. Some one of you go to the house and see what the fellow is doing."
Another head, the head of a young woman, immediately rose up and flitted to the house, lightly as a bat. I like that word, flitted. I'm imagining all these heads flitting around.
Yeah.
After a few minutes, it came back and cried out huskily in a tone of great alarm.
Young woman goblin head scared? Okay. I got this one.
"The traveling priest is not in the house. He's gone. But that is not the worst of the matter. He has taken the body of our Aruji, and I do not know where he has put it."
At this announcement, the head of the Aruji, distinctly visible in the moonlight, assumed a frightful aspect. Its eyes opened monstrously, its hair stood up bristling, and its teeth gnashed. Then a cry burst from its lips, and, weeping tears of rage, it exclaimed,
"Since my body has been moved, to rejoin it is not possible! Then I must die! And all through the work of that priest! Before I die, I will get at that priest. I will tear him. I will devour him. And there he is, behind that tree, hiding behind that tree. See him, the fat coward?"
"I'm not fat. That hurts."
In the same moment, the head of the Aruji, followed by the other four heads, sprang at Kairyo. But the strong priest had already armed himself by plucking up a young tree. And with that tree, he struck the heads as they came, knocking them from him with tremendous blows. I'm imagining him swinging it like a baseball bat, you know?
Yeah. And they like fly 50 feet away and then like start coming back towards him again.
Yeah. Four of them fled away. But the head of the Aruji, though battered again and again, desperately continued to bound at the priest and at last caught him by the left sleeve of his robe. Kairyo, however, as quickly gripped the head by its top knot and repeatedly struck it. It did not release its hold, but it uttered a long moan. And thereafter ceased to struggle. It was dead. But its teeth still held the sleeve, and for all his great strength, Kairyo could not force open the jaws. With the head still hanging to his sleeve, he went back to the house, and there caught sight of the other four Rokurokubi squatting together with their bruised and bleeding heads reunited to their bodies. But when they perceived him at the back door, all screamed,
"The priest! The priest!"
and fled through the other doorway out into the woods. Eastward, the sky was brightening. Day was about to dawn, and Kairyo knew that the power of the goblins was limited to the hours of darkness. He looked at the head clinging to his sleeve, its face all fouled with blood and foam and clay, and he laughed aloud as he thought to himself,
"What a miyage!
A present made to friends or to the household on returning from a journey is thus called.
The head of a goblin! He's going to give a goblin head to his buddies?"
Barely. More to the note here.
Oh, sorry.
Ordinarily, of course, the miyage consists of something produced in the locality to which the journey has been made. This is the point of Kairyo's jest.
That's cool that this was written like 120 years ago.
They still have that tradition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
And we talked about that in the train stations episode, maybe, where you like get your,
for sure,
your specialty food before you head back.
Yep. After which, he gathered together his few belongings and leisurely descended the mountain to continue his journey. Right on he journeyed until he came to Suwa in Shinano,
present-day Nagano Prefecture.
And into the main street of Suwa he solemnly strode with the head dangling at his elbow. Then women fainted, and children screamed and ran away, and there was a great crowding and clamoring until the torite, as the police in those days were called, seized the priest and took him to jail. For they supposed the head to be the head of a murdered man, who, in the moment of being killed, had caught the murderer's sleeve in his teeth.
Wait, so how long? He didn't put this head in a bag? Like, he was just walking around carrying a severed head?
He's not, I mean, it's just hanging from his sleeve.
Through multiple prefectures? Oh, yeah, he couldn't get it off the sleeve, right? Yeah.
What was he going to do, go naked?
Get a new robe? Cut his sleeve off? I don't know.
The robe is perfectly good still. It's just
got other than the head hanging from it.
Nothing wrong with that. It's a novelty.
He's a priest of limited means, I suppose. I should give him some slack.
Yeah, right? As for Kaerio, he only smiled and said nothing when they questioned him. So, after having passed a night in prison, he was brought before the magistrates of the district. Then he was ordered to explain how he, a priest, had been found with the head of a man fastened to his sleeve, and why he had dared thus shamelessly to parade his crime in the sight of people. Kaerio laughed long and loudly at these questions, and then he said,
"Sirs, I did not fasten the head to my sleeve. It fastened itself there, much against my will. And I have not committed any crime, for this is not the head of a man. It is the head of a goblin, guys. And if I caused the death of the goblin, I did not do so by any shedding of blood, but simply by taking the precautions necessary to assure my own safety."
I feel like this voice is drifting. I feel like that happens a lot. I don't know. And he proceeded to relate the whole of the adventure, bursting into another hearty laugh as he told of his encounter with the five heads. But the magistrates did not laugh. They judged him to be a hardened criminal, and his story an insult to their intelligence. Therefore, without further questioning, they decided to order his immediate execution. All except one, a very old man. This aged officer had made no remark during the trial, but after having heard the opinion of his colleagues, he rose up and said,
"Let us first examine the head carefully, for this, I think, has not yet been done. If the priest has spoken truth, the head itself should bear witness for him. Bring the head here."
So the head, still holding in its teeth the koromo that had been stripped from Kaerio's shoulders, was put before the judges. So he's just standing there naked now? That must have been like a overgarment, right?
Yeah, maybe. He's got his loincloth on still.
So I guess he was just parading it around for fun.
Yeah, told you he didn't need to.
The old man turned it round and round, carefully examined it, and discovered, on the nape of its neck, several strange red characters. He called the attention of his colleagues to these, and also bade them observe that the edges of the neck nowhere presented the appearance of having been cut by any weapon. On the contrary, the line of leverance? That must be a typo, right? The line of severance, I would think.
Maybe. Maybe it's a weird old English thing.
Maybe. The line of cutting, I assume that's what they're talking about, was smooth as the line at which a falling leaf detaches itself from the stem. Then said the elder,
"I am quite sure that the priest told us nothing but the truth. This is the head of a Roku Rokubi. In the book Nanhoi Butsu Shi, it is written that certain red characters can always be found upon the nape of the neck of a real Roku Rokubi. There are the characters you can see for yourselves that they have not been painted. Moreover, it is well known that such goblins have been dwelling in the mountains of the province of Kai from very ancient time. But you, sir,"
he exclaimed, turning to Kaerio,
"what sort of sturdy priest may you be? Certainly you have given proof of a courage that few priests possess, and you have the air of a soldier rather than a priest. Perhaps you once belonged to the samurai class?"
"Well, I have been known to sleep kind of anywhere, and like if it snows a bunch on me and stuff, it's nothing. I just get up and brush it off and it's fine."
That's the heart of an infantryman. Sleep anywhere, anytime.
"You have guessed rightly, sir," Kaerio responded. Before becoming a priest, I long followed the profession of arms, and in those days I never feared man or devil. Or snow. My name then was Isogai Heidazaimon Taketsura of Kyushu. There may be some among you who remember it.
I didn't want to stop you right away because it was the first sentence of a long story, but this guy's name, bro. What a name.
The Isogai Heidazaimon Taketsura?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good name. And, you know, I think this goes back to just not having a standardized way of translating Japanese to English, but you notice the, what's that even called? Where you got the two dots over a vowel?
The umlaut? I don't know.
I can never remember. Is that the umlaut or is it the little U thing?
Yeah, I don't know. It's been too long.
But anyway, it's got all these accents on there that I've never seen before on a Japanese word.
Right, right.
At the mention of that name, that really awesome name, a murmur of admiration filled the courtroom, for there were many present who remembered it. And Kairyo immediately found himself among friends instead of judges, friends anxious to prove their admiration by fraternal kindness. With honor, they escorted him to the residence of the daimyo, who welcomed him and feasted him and made him a handsome present before allowing him to depart. When Kairyo left Suwa, he was as happy as any priest is permitted to be in this transitory world. I like that. That's a good sentence right there.
Yeah.
As for the head, he took it with him, jocosely insisting that he intended it for a miyage. What a good joke.
Jocosely? Spelled like that? What?
I think it means jokingly. Like jocular?
Okay, the same root. Maybe that's where it came from. Okay.
And now it only remains to tell what became of the head. That's why this story is so long. There's a second part to it about the head.
Okay.
A day or two after leaving Suwa, Kairyo met with a robber who stopped him in a lonesome place and bade him strip. Seems like an odd thing for the robber to demand first.
Gotta make sure he's not hiding his valuables in that loincloth, Jason.
Okay. Kairyo at once removed his koromo and offered it to the robber, who then first perceived what was hanging to the sleeve. Though brave, the highwayman was startled. He dropped the garment and sprang back. Then he cried out,
"You! What kind of priest are you? Why, you are a worse man than I am. It is true that I have killed people, but I never walked about with anybody's head fastened to my sleeve. Well, sir priest, I suppose we are of the same calling, and I must say that I admire you. Now that head would be of use to me. I could frighten people with it. Will you sell it? You can have my robe in exchange for your koromo, and I will give you 5 ryo for the head."
So he's a robber. Why doesn't he just take it? Like, it's in his hands. Is it because he respects how terrifying this guy is that he's like, okay, I'll pay you for it?
Yeah, he now thinks they're both robbers. Like, respect of the trade or something? I don't know.
What's that? Isn't there a no honor among thieves?
I suppose that's must not be a Japanese saying.
I guess. Anyway, Kairyo answered, "I shall let you have the head and the robe if you insist, but I must tell you that this is not the head of a man. It's a goblin's head, so if you buy it and have any trouble in consequence, please to remember that you were not deceived by me."
"What a nice priest you are," exclaimed the robber. "You kill men and just about it. But I am really in earnest. Here is my robe, and here is the money, and let me have the head. What is the use of joking?"
"Take the thing," said Kairyo. "I was not joking. The only joke, if there be any joke at all, is that you are fool enough to pay good money for a goblin's head, you dummy."
And Kairyo, loudly laughing, went upon his way. Thus, the robber got the head and the koromo, and for some time he played goblin priest upon the highways. But reaching the neighborhood of Suwa, he there learned the true story of the head, and he then became afraid that the spirit of the Rokurokubi might give him trouble. So he made up his mind to take back the head to the place from which it had come and to bury it with its body. He found his way to the lonely cottage in the mountains of Kai, but nobody was there, and he could not discover the body. Therefore, he buried the head by itself in the grove behind the cottage, and he had a tombstone set up over the grave, and he caused a Seigaki service to be performed on behalf of the spirit of the Rokurokubi, and that tombstone, known as the tombstone of the Rokurokubi, may be seen, at least so the Japanese storyteller declares, even unto this day.
Wow.
I'd love to see that tombstone.
Right?
That's the end.
Nice story. Nice story.
I liked that. Had you read that one?
No, I hadn't.
Nice.
That was new to me.
Pretty creepy, huh?
Yeah. Like so many tales, they're so afraid of getting haunted, you know? Give it a proper burial, give it a tombstone, do the prayers.
I'm pretty sure we mentioned that Seigaki service in the yokai episode too.
Mm.
Like it's a way to kind of, you know, put a soul at rest or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Nice. All right, I'm going to do another short story from this same Lafcadio Hearn collection. This one is called Jūroku Zakura.
Jūroku, it means 16.
Oh.
And Zakura would be Sakura, cherry blossoms.
Man, when I was first learning Japanese, which I never obviously got very far, I think I was 14. And that was one of the first things we learned to say was our age.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I remember anymore.
You don't remember 14?
You're
talking about your current age.
I definitely don't know my current age. I was 14. What's four?
Yon.
Yon. Juyon? Juyon Saides? Juyon Saides.
Yep.
There we go. I remembered a thing.
Very good.
In Wakigori, a district of the province of Iyo,
present-day Ehime Prefecture,
there is a very ancient and famous cherry tree called Jūroku Zakura, or the cherry tree of the 16th day, because it blooms every year upon the 16th day of the first month by the old lunar calendar, and only upon that day.
Thus, interesting, because in the other story you read, there was another cherry tree that bloomed on the 16th day of the second month.
Yes. This one does not lactate, though.
That's a shame.
Thus, the time of its flowering is the period of great cold.
So it does have a period.
Oh, I see what you did there. Though the natural habit of a cherry tree is to wait for the spring season before venturing to blossom. But the Jūroku Zakura blossoms with a life that is not, or at least that was not originally its own. There is the ghost of a man in that tree.
What?
He was a samurai of Iyo, and the tree grew in his garden, and it used to flower at the usual time. That is to say, about the end of March or the beginning of April. He had played under that tree when he was a child, and his parents and grandparents and ancestors had hung to its blossoming branches season after season for more than 100 years, bright strips of colored paper inscribed with poems and praise. He himself became very old, outliving all his children, and there was nothing in the world left for him to love except that tree. And lo, in the summer of a certain year, the tree withered and died. Exceedingly the old man sorrowed for his tree. Then kind neighbors found for him a young and beautiful cherry tree and planted it in his garden, hoping thus to comfort him. And he thanked them and pretended to be glad, but really, his heart was full of pain, for he had loved the old tree so well that nothing could have consoled him for the loss of it. At last, there came to him a happy thought. He remembered a way by which the perishing tree might be saved. It was the 16th day of the first month. Along he went into his garden and bowed down before the withered tree and spoke to it, saying, "Now, deign, I beseech you, once more to bloom, because I am going to die in your stead."
He's doing the same thing that other lady did.
I got the self-sacrificial stories going tonight.
Yeah, weird parallels between these two.
"For it is believed that one can really give away one's life to another person, or to a creature, or even to a tree, by the favor of the gods, and thus to transfer one's life is expressed by the term Migawari ni Tatsu, to act as a substitute. Then under that tree he spread a white cloth and divers coverings, and sat down upon the coverings and performed harakiri after the fashion of a samurai. And the ghost of him went into the tree and made it blossom in that same hour. And every year it still blossoms on the 16th day of the first month in the season of snow.
Sweet. What do you think? Would you want to be a ghost in a tree?
Yeah, I love trees.
Seems a little limiting, though. Like, you just get to watch things change from that one vantage point. I'd rather float around, you know?
Yeah, but, like, a lot of ghosts are limited. They're limited to a certain area or a certain time or whatever, you know? Sure.
But I'd rather be, you know, limited to a house that I could haunt rather than just a tree.
Right, but if you become the tree, what kind of senses does a tree have? A tree's big. A tree's everywhere. Like,
how do you
perceive the world?
There are a lot of things living on the tree. Maybe it just becomes a whole world where you're like paying attention to all the little ants and the bees.
Yeah, the worms, the ants, the birds. Your roots go deep down into the ground. Everybody gathers around you once a year when you bloom and goes, ooh, ah, and gives you love.
I guess this is a better way to be a ghost than like to be, you know, murdered in some horrible way or something.
Yeah, I don't even know if he's a ghost. He kind of just like transferred his life. I don't know, maybe that makes him a ghost. Hey, we got time for your next one, or should I do one more short one?
I wouldn't mind reading another one if that's okay with you.
Yeah, please do.
You can have some voices in there too.
Awesome.
This one's from a different collection. I'm going back to Japanese fairy tales compiled by Yei Theodora Ozaki. And this story is called The Goblin of Adachigahara.
Goblin, that's promising.
At first I thought it might be a tengu. That's usually translated as a goblin, but I don't think that's what's going on here.
Okay.
Ready?
Yeah.
Long, long ago, there was a large plain called Adachigahara in the province of Mutsu in Japan. This place was said to be haunted by a cannibal goblin who took the form of an old woman. From time to time, many travelers disappeared and were never heard of more, and the old women around the charcoal braziers in the evenings and the girls washing the household rice at the wells in the mornings whispered dreadful stories of how the missing folk had been lured to the goblin's cottage and devoured, for the goblin lived only on human flesh. Oh, by the way, there's some blood and stuff in this one, just, you know, just to let you know.
Man, if he lived only on human flesh, there must have been a large population of humans nearby to support him.
I guess so.
You need a new human every week.
Who knows what his metabolism is like, though, you know?
Yeah, I suppose he's a magical being. Who knows?
How long would a village even last nearby if he had to eat like a person a day or something?
Right.
Or maybe he's like a hunter-gatherer type goblin, you know? He's always got to roam around and go to a new place where there's more food.
Maybe the story was told from the human's perspective, and they only say that and they're wrong.
Oh, like they don't know what the goblins eat? They only know that it does sometimes eat humans?
Yeah, they're all like, he only eats human flesh, and he's out there picking berries.
Who knows? I doubt that they've had a chance to study the anatomy of goblins.
Right.
Anyway, I think we're probably thinking too hard about this.
Yeah.
No one dared to venture near the haunted spot after sunset, and all those who could avoided it in the daytime, and travelers were warned of the dreaded place. One day, as the sun was setting, a priest came to the plain. He was a belated traveler, and his robe showed that he was a Buddhist pilgrim walking from shrine to shrine to pray for some blessing or to crave for forgiveness of sins. He had apparently lost his way, and as it was late, he met no one who could show him the road or warn him of the haunted spot. He had walked the whole day, and was now tired and hungry, and the evenings were chilly, for it was late autumn. And he began to be very anxious to find some house where he could obtain a night's lodging. He found himself lost in the midst of the large plain, and looked about in vain for some sign of human habitation.
At last, after wandering about for some hours, he saw a clump of trees in the distance, and through the trees he caught sight of the glimmer of a single ray of light. He exclaimed with joy,
"Oh, surely that is some cottage where I can get a night's lodging."
Keeping the light before his eyes, he dragged his weary, aching feet as quickly as he could towards the spot, and soon came to a miserable-looking little cottage. As he drew near, he saw that it was in a tumble-down condition. The bamboo fence was broken, and weeds and grass pushed their way through the gaps. The paper screens, which serve as windows and doors in Japan, were full of holes, and the posts of the house were bent with age and seemed scarcely able to support the old thatched roof. The hut was open, and by the light of an old lantern, an old woman sat, industriously spinning. The pilgrim called to her across the bamboo fence and said,
"Oba-san!"
Old woman.
"Good evening. I am a traveler. Please excuse me, but I have lost my way, and I do not know what to do, for I have nowhere to rest tonight. I beg you to be good enough to let me spend the night under your roof."
The old woman, as soon as she heard herself spoken to, stopped spinning, rose from her seat, and approached the intruder.
"I am very sorry for you. You must indeed be distressed to have lost your way in such a lonely spot so late at night. Unfortunately, I cannot put you up, for I have no bed to offer you, and no accommodation whatsoever for a guest in this poor place."
"Oh, that does not matter," said the priest. "All I want is a shelter under some roof for the night. And if you will be good enough to just let me lie on the kitchen floor, I shall be grateful. I am too tired to walk further tonight, so I hope you will not refuse me. Otherwise, I shall have to sleep out in the cold plain."
And in this way, he pressed the old woman to let him stay. She seemed very reluctant, but at last she said,
"Very well. I will let you stay here. I can offer you a very poor welcome only. But come in now, and I will make a fire, for the night is cold."
The pilgrim was only too glad to do as he was told. He took off his sandals and entered the hut. The old woman then brought some sticks of wood and lit the fire, and bade her guest draw near and warm himself.
"You must be hungry after your long tramp," said the old woman. "I will go and cook some supper for you."
Then she went to the kitchen to cook some rice. After the priest had finished his supper, the old woman sat down by the fireplace, and they talked together for a long time. The pilgrim thought to himself that he had been very lucky to come across such a kind, hospitable old woman. At last, the wood gave out, and as the fire died slowly down, he began to shiver with cold, just as he had done when he arrived.
"I see you are cold," said the old woman.
"I will go out and gather some wood, for we have used it all. You must stay and take care of the house while I am gone."
"No, no,"
said the pilgrim.
"Let me go instead, for you are old, and I cannot think of letting you go out to get wood for me this cold night."
The old woman shook her head and said,
"You must stay quietly here, for you are my guest."
Then she left him and went out. In a minute, she came back and said,
"You must sit where you are and not move, and whatever happens, don't go near or look into the inner room. Now mind what I tell you." "If you tell me not to go near the back room, of course I won't," said the priest, rather bewildered.
The old woman then went out again, and the priest was left alone. The fire had died out, and the only light in the hut was that of a dim lantern. For the first time that night, he began to feel that he was in a weird place, and the old woman's words,
"Whatever you do, don't peep into the back room,"
aroused his curiosity and his fear. What hidden thing could be in that room that she did not wish him to see? For some time, the remembrance of his promise to the old woman kept him still, but at last, he could no longer resist his curiosity to peep into the forbidden place. He got up and began to move slowly towards the back room. Then the thought that the old woman would be very angry with him if he disobeyed her made him come back to his place by the fireside. As the minutes went slowly by and the old woman did not return,
He began to feel more and more frightened, and to wonder what dreadful secret was in the room behind him. He must find out.
She will not know that I have looked unless I tell her. I will just have a peep before she comes back,
said the man to himself. With these words, he got up on his feet, for he had been sitting all this time in Japanese fashion with his feet under him, and stealthily crept towards the forbidden spot. With trembling hands, he pushed back the sliding door and looked in. What he saw froze the blood in his veins. The room was full of dead men's bones, and the walls were splashed, and the floor was covered with human blood.
Whoa.
In one corner, skull upon skull rose to the ceiling. In another was a heap of arm bones. In another, a heap of leg bones. The sickening smell made him faint. He fell backwards with horror, and for some time lay in a heap with fright on the floor, a pitiful sight. He trembled all over, and his teeth chattered, and he could hardly crawl away from the dreadful spot.
How horrible!
He cried out.
What awful den have I come to in my travels? May Buddha help me, or I am lost. Is it possible that that kind old woman is really the cannibal goblin? When she comes back, she will show herself in her true character and eat me up at one mouthful.
What does he mean, the cannibal goblin? I thought he had never heard about this place.
Right? That's what I was wondering.
It seems like a plot hole. With these words, his strength came back to him, and snatching up his hat and staff, he rushed out of the house as fast as his legs could carry him. Out into the night he ran, his one thought to get as far as he could from the goblin's haunt. He had not gone far when he heard steps behind him and a voice crying,
"Stop! Stop!"
He ran on, redoubling his speed, pretending not to hear. As he ran, he heard the steps behind him come nearer and nearer, and at last he recognized the old woman's voice, which grew louder and louder as she came nearer.
"Stop! Stop, you wicked man! Why did you look into the forbidden room?"
The priest quite forgot how tired he was, and his feet flew over the ground faster than ever. Fear gave him strength, for he knew that if the goblin caught him, he would soon be one of her victims. With all his heart, he repeated the prayer to Buddha.
Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu.
But he's like out of breath and running, you know.
Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu.
Very nice. And after him rushed the dreadful old hag, her hair flying in the wind and her face changing with rage into the demon that she was. In her hand, she carried a large blood-stained knife, and she still shrieked after him,
"Stop! Stop!"
At last, when the priest felt he could run no more, the dawn broke, and with the darkness of night, the goblin vanished and he was safe. The priest now knew that he had met the goblin of Adachigahara, the story of whom he had often heard but never believed to be true. Okay, so I guess he had heard about it.
All right, that story's spread wide.
Let me go back to the beginning, because I swear it said, as it was late, he met no one who could show him the road or warn him of the haunted spot. It says that.
He just didn't know that was the particular spot.
Okay, he'd heard the story, he just didn't know where exactly this thing was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Okay. It makes sense now. He felt that he owed his wonderful escape to the protection of Buddha, to whom he had prayed for help. So he took out his rosary, and bowing his head as the sun rose, he said his prayers and made his thanksgiving earnestly. He then set forward for another part of the country, only too glad to leave the haunted plain behind him.
Wow. That was a cool story.
I thought that was a nice Halloween-y one.
I do have to wonder about the goblin, though. Like, when was she going to kill him?
Yeah, I was wondering, why was she so nice to him at the beginning? She could have killed him at any point.
Yeah, she's like, go away. I don't have space here. And then he forces his way in, and she's like, he's in her house for hours, and she doesn't kill him.
Instead, they were like, they were talking late into the night. Like, what were they talking about? I want to know.
Even goblins got to get news of the outside world, right? I like how she stacked all her bones neatly, like leg bones over here, skulls in that corner.
Yeah, that's kind of unusual. Really organized, but she's living in this ramshackle That's the word, right? Ramshackle?
Yeah.
Cottage?
That's a word.
Okay. I never use that word. I don't know. Sometimes I find myself saying words that I don't normally use. And then I'm like, wait a minute, is that right? Is that how people say it?
Right. I can't recall ever using that word. I'd almost laugh. This is a ramshackle place. Like, when would you say that?
Is that an old-timey word?
Kind of, yeah.
Maybe we should start bringing back some old-timey words, you know?
I'm with you there.
I was actually thinking, I was listening to this other podcast where they were talking about how, like, when you've been podcasting for a while, eventually you listen back and you're like, man, I just keep using the same words over and over again. I need to expand my vocabulary. I was thinking we should find new words because I'm always like, I mean, you're doing fine, Paul. I'm just talking about me. I always say things are awesome and beautiful. I feel like when we're talking about places in Japan, I use those a lot.
I'm with you there too, because I think about that. Even when I'm taking my notes, I'm like describing like, how many sentences can I use beautiful in a row in, even if I'm talking about a bunch of different beautiful stuff. Like, it's amazing, it's breathtaking, it's beautiful, it's gorgeous. Like,
well, for our next episodes, when we're doing our trip recaps, I'm going to have a list of really big words that I can insert when I'm describing the places that we have seen.
It's an awe-inspiring view. You know, they have a thesaurus. Do they have a thesaurus, but like old-timey themed? Like, what would this word be in 1800s English?
That would be fun.
I wonder if that exists online somewhere.
I'm sure. It's gotta.
That would be pretty cool.
I bet there are places where you can just type something in and then tell it to translate it to old English.
Yeah.
Or with AI these days. I bet you could do that with ChatGPT.
I bet it could. Another thought I was having is, like, you were talking earlier about how it's hard to maintain a consistent voice throughout a whole story. Yeah. It really goes to how impressive voice actors are.
Yeah, totally.
Like, obviously, you and I aren't trained, but like that's why it's trained professionals that work for years doing this to get that high quality voice acting.
Yeah. They make it look so easy when you see like interviews with them on talk shows or whatever.
Yeah, they switch into the voice. Yeah. Like I'm telling a 20-minute story and my voice drifts totally throughout the story, in and out and all over the place.
Yeah.
They just like year after year keep doing these same voices. And the people that do multiple voices, like some people will do like three different characters of the same anime and you can't even tell it's them.
Right, right. We'll have to practice. I bet there are YouTube videos that'll teach us how to be better voice actors.
Probably. I have to practice and get like a bag of like 10 voices. I definitely need an old lady voice. I need an old man voice. I need a monster voice.
I was starting to think it'd be fun to just like start giving everybody weird accents. That would be a good way to create new characters, you know?
Accents are even harder, dude. I don't even know. I suppose if you study though, like always elongate the A's, and you could probably pick up like a few little tricks that would like help you be much better with an accent.
Well, I feel like I can do an all right, like southern kind of accent.
Southern drawl.
There are a whole bunch of southern accents.
True that.
I don't know. Maybe I drift between a bunch of different southern accents.
Yeah. Would you get like a southern accent too? It's almost like what words I'm saying. Till I get into it, I'm like, take the cattle down yonder on pale. You know, like you gotta like say something southern to like get into a voice. Oh, that's more like Texan, maybe.
You could probably lean into the Minnesota accent.
I think I already accidentally am. Every year, my Minnesota accent gets worse and worse. Dude.
The other week, we went apple picking.
Nice.
And like the apple picking place, it's not that far out of the cities, you know?
Yeah.
But when I called them to like ask if the Honeycrisp apples were available to pick, I was just stunned at how Minnesotan the person that answered the phone sounded. And
those Honeycrisp are ready to go.
And then when we went down there and went to pay for the apples, the person at the checkout had a super strong Minnesotan accent too. And I was like amazed that it comes out so strongly, really not that far outside of the cities. You don't have to go that far to hear it.
Yeah. I'm bad for a city dweller, but not nearly on the level of some rural folks. Yeah.
It's entertaining though. Accents are fun.
Absolutely. If you make fun of accents, but nah, accents are cool.
Totally. Well, have we rambled long enough? Should we end this episode?
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay. Well, if you'd like to see some pictures of stuff in Japan, I anticipate there'll probably be a whole lot coming up soon on Instagram, because I'm currently, as you're listening to this, probably taking thousands of pictures. And I'm hoping to take more videos, too. I want to take more videos this time.
Yeah.
You can find us on Instagram. We're at SJP Podcast. And you're on Twitter, right, Paul?
Yes. Posting random retweets of Japan facts.
Sorry, X. Twitter doesn't exist. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can never remember that.
Everyone, like, has to call it out. Like, I read articles and they'll be like, this person said on social media platform X. Like, they just can't say X. And I was like, what?
You're also SJP Podcast there, right?
Yes.
Okay. And before we go, let me shout out to our Shogun level patrons: Wesley C., Nicholas McKibben, Kevin Harris, Brady K., Jack, Michael Morris, David Imani, Darwin Perrier, Ethan Teague, Yasmin, Jason, Katarina and Ellery, Susan, Tori, Shaked Rosenthal, Tina Anderson, Alexa Gonzalez, and Pamela Arola. Thank you all so, so much.
Thank you.
And if anyone else would like to join the Patreon, you can do that on our website, sightseeingjapanpodcast.com. The Support Us page has a link to the Patreon, or you could just search for Sightseeing Japan on Patreon. You know, there are a bunch of ways to find it. Well, as I hinted at before, next episode is going to be our trip recap, or first trip recap of three. First of three.
We're assuming three. We're going to see so much stuff that it's unlikely we can get through it in a reasonable amount of time.
Well, last time we did one episode per week, and I'm going to be there for 3 weeks, so.
Yeah, yeah. I remember the first week when you were, like, detailing every piece of food you ate. Although I bet some people love that, right? Because it's a huge part of, like, traveling for a lot of people is, what am I going to eat?
It's hard not to just go on and on and on about every single little detail because, you know, that's when I feel alive, is in Japan. And every moment is special to me, you know?
Right. And during the recaps, we're looking at pictures. And you take a picture of all the food you eat. So it keeps coming up. And you're like, oh, yeah, that was the great thing I had.
We'll look through my several thousands of pictures and videos and comment on every single one. It's going
to
be great.
You might have to curate it to a few hundred or something.
I'll try. I don't know. We'll see. Well, thanks for listening. See you next time.
But as the proverb has it.
You said proverb.
Proverb.
You've had trouble with that word before. I recall.
But as the proverb has it. That's but as the proverb. 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 English is weird. But as the proverb. Dang it. Proverb. Proverb? Is that, how do you say it? I can't say
proverb.
It.
Proverb. You just proverb. Said it.
Okay. That sounds wrong.
It's not.
But as the proverb has it, kunshi ayaku.
Nope.
Proverb.
You said proverb.
But as the proverb has it, kunshi ayakuki ni chiki ya. Oh my god. Kunshi ayaku ni chika yoraz.
Ayayuki ni.
Ayayuki. Kunchi ayayuki ni chika yo razu.